again. This is Randall Rickman from Triangle. Let me correct that. This is Randall Rickman from North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as Triangle Reading Service. This is the new edition of Time Magazine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time. This edition is dated September 16th, 2019. This content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. First, we go right back to the end of the magazine so we can include this week's interview feature. And this time it's called Six Questions. The interview subject is Gina Rippon. Time says, the British cognitive researcher on why male and female brains aren't so different explored in her book, Gender and Our Brains. Gina Rippon. Rippon is spelled R-I-P-P-O-N. Interview conducted by Jeffrey Kluger. Question 1. A popular notion has it that a human being's most important sex organ is the brain. You say it's our behavior that's different. Our brains are strikingly similar. Why? Answer. This goes all the way back to Charles Darwin, who said that women are inferior because they have inferior brains, and therefore they do not have the right to assume a powerful role in society. But the bottom line is, there is no consistent pattern or structure which reliably characterizes the brain, so that we could say, okay, that's a female brain, and that's a male brain. Unquote. Question. But we don't have to be talking about inferior or superior brains, just different brains. Answer. Absolutely. Some critics have called people like myself sex difference deniers, like climate deniers. There are sex differences that we should pay attention to, but the power that's attributed to biology is what needs challenging. We have to pay more attention to how our experiences drive our brain architecture. It's a bit like trees that grow on windy plains. Their biological drivers make them grow upward, but the winds make them twist or grow branches on only one side. Question. Is this what you mean by the, quote, pink and blue tsunami, unquote, you write about in your book? Answer. Yes, and it starts early. There was a BBC program called No More Boys and Girls, and they showed a classroom with a blue cupboard for the boys' coats and a pink cupboard for the girls, and no one knew why. It suggests that there's something so important about your sex that you have to hang your coat somewhere else. Question. You're open about the fact that you hate gender reveal parties. Answer. I've called them jaw-droppingly awful. 20 weeks before children even arrive, people are already stressing about how important it is to be a boy or a girl. Question. A lot of parents work hard to raise their kids without strict gender differences. Can that compete with the gender messages in the culture at large? Answer. Children are tiny social sponges, and it starts early. Little boys quickly pick up the fact that they shouldn't cry, that if they want to be on the football team, then in British terms, stiff upper lip. Is that what you call it in America? Question, starting with answer by the questioner. Suck it up is what we'd say. It's a little more vulgar. Answer, yeah, but telling, actually. Question. If we can't lay gender differences off on brain structure, surely hormones play a role, don't they? Answer. They're obviously powerful. Yes, but they're responsive to the social environment. Testosterone, for example, is not the one-directional driver people say it is. The father of a newborn baby, who is the primary caregiver of the baby, will have a much lower testosterone level than the father who is not the primary caregiver. Question. Rightly or wrongly, much has been written about women's empathy and collegiality and how the world would be more peaceful if there were more female heads of state. Do you agree? Answer. I think the best way forward would be gender irrelevance. If good leaders need to be empathic, networking, collegial, then let's encourage that. If good leaders need to be assertive, thick-skinned, able to make rapid decisions, let's encourage that too. Final question. You spend little time in your book on transgender people. How come? Answer. I don't do research in that area, and I think you need to be a genuine authority. I've been contacted by transgender males or females who ask, can you put me in a scanner and prove my brain is male or female? I say, I'm sorry, there isn't any such thing. I can't say your brain is all pinks or blues. In fact, I need to call my book 50 Shades of Grey Matter. Interview by Jeffrey Kluger with British cognitive researcher Gina Rippon. And the actual name of her book is Gender and Our Brains. Now going to the front of the magazine, and we're now on the recurring feature For the Record. And it's a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated with a two-color drawing or a headline or caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation, quote, from Frank-Walter Steinmeier, German president, at a September 1st ceremony marking the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Poland. And the quote from German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, quote, I affirm our lasting responsibility, unquote, on the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Poland. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 96. Caption explains age of the oldest active male scuba diver, World War II vet Ray Woodley, who plunged 42.4 meters, parenthetically nearly 140 feet, for 48 minutes to mark his August 28th birthday, beating his personal record by 1.8 meters and 4 minutes, 96 years old. In the lower right margin of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Ariana Grande, she's suing Forever 21, arguing it used a model that looked like her on social media. Under Good Week, Taylor Swift, with Lover, she scores the biggest sales week for any album since 2017's Reputation. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic 304.8. Caption says, speed in miles per hour achieved by Bugatti's new sports car in a test track in the German town of Erlestlin, 304.8 miles per hour. That is also accompanied by a red, white, and black line drawing, presumably of that Bugatti. In the middle left margin of the page. The story illustrated by a quotation from Kristen Stewart, star of the upcoming Charlie's Angel movie, to Harper's Bazaar on pressure to downplay her sexuality. The quotation from Kristen Stewart to Harper's Bazaar, quote, "If you don't go out holding your girlfriend's hand in public, you might get a Marvel movie," unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quote from Jeremy Corbyn, leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party, on September 3rd, when Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party lost its majority after one lawmaker defected and 21 were expelled for joining a rebel bid to make a no-deal Brexit illegal. The quotation from Britain's opposition Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, quote, in red, "His is a government with no mandate, no morals, and, as of today, no majority," unquote. The upper center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Joe Biden, former vice president and 2020 presidential candidate. Joe Biden arguing on September 3rd that his habit of mixing up names and dates don't affect his judgment. The quotation from former Vice President Joe Biden in caps and bold black, quote, "Details are irrelevant in terms of decision-making," unquote. Caption goes on to say, his statement came after the Washington Post reported that a war story he told combined details from at least three different events. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Coco Gauff, tennis player. Coco Gauff on opponent Naomi Osaka, who consoled the 15-year-old after beating her at the U.S. Open on August 21st. And the quotation from Coco Gauff, quote, "The definition of an athlete is someone who on the court treats you like your worst enemy, but off the court can be your best friend," unquote. Of the entire content of the For the Record page, we now enter the magazine and we're in the front section called Brief. And the subsection here is the bulletin, where the headline is, India's Register of Citizens leaves nearly 2 million people off the list and at risk. Article by Billy Perigo. When India's National Register of Citizens, parenthetically NRC, was published on August 31st, after a six-year effort to catalog all legal residents of the state of Assam, some 1.9 million people, mostly Bengali speakers accused of being, quote, infiltrators, unquote, from Bangladesh, were left off the list. Their exclusion, the first step in an experiment the Indian government says it wants to replicate nationwide, puts them at risk of statelessness. Rights groups warn it could also presage a humanitarian crisis in the world's largest democracy. And here Billy Perigo lists three items. First item, citizens of nowhere. To be deemed a true citizen, residents of Assam had to provide documentation dating prior to March 24, 1971, the day before the eruption of a war with East Pakistan that spurred a wave of migration. Rights groups say that burden of proof is too high for many families that don't keep meticulous records dating back nearly half a century, and especially for women, the illiterate, and people who have fled persecution. Second item, struck off. The NRC process in Assam has roots in a history of acute anxiety about successive waves of immigration to the state by Bengali speakers, many of whom are Muslim. When Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power in 2014, he seized on the issue, which dovetailed with his Hindu nationalist message that India's Hindus are being displaced by Muslims, who make up 14% of India's population. Final item, what next? It's unclear if India can actually expel people, as most people left off the NRC hold no other citizenship. It would be illegal under humanitarian law for India to make them stateless, and Bangladesh is unlikely to accept the people India attempts to deport. With thousands already detained in Assam, at least 10 new detention camps are being built, and family separations seem likely. And the government still wants to roll out the NRC nationwide. Quote, "We will," unquote, Home Minister Amit Shah said, quote, "remove every single infiltrator," unquote. Entire article by Billy Perigo. And as a reminder and a correction to your readers' gaffes earlier, you are listening to North Carolina Reading Service. We are now at the sidebar of that page for the regular feature news ticker. It's three news items stacked one on top of the other in the right margin. Top item, Iran says no to bilateral talks with U.S. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, said that he'd never hold bilateral talks with the U.S. and that dialogue on reviving a nuclear deal could resume only if the U.S. lifted all sanctions on Iran. His September 3rd announcement came alongside reports that French President Emmanuel Macron offered Iran $15 billion in credit to keep the old deal alive. Middle item, Pence stays at Trump Golf Club in Ireland. Vice President Mike Pence stayed at President Trump's private golf club during an official trip to Ireland at Trump's, quote, suggestion, unquote. Pence Chief of Staff Mark Short said on September 3rd. Facing criticism of taxpayer funds going to the president's business, the vice president defended the move as, quote, logical, unquote. Bottom item, Italy leaves right-wing party out. The anti-establishment five-star movement in Italy backed a coalition with its former political rival, the center-left Democratic Party, in order to keep the far-right League out of power. Led by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, the new government is to be sworn in on September 5th. Moving ahead, and we are now at the regular feature milestones. The lead item under Died, Valerie Harper, TV's pioneering real woman. Observance written by Judy Berman. Over the course of six decades in show business, Valerie Harper played dozens of roles. Even after receiving a cancer diagnosis in 2009, she kept popping up delightfully in film, TV, and on the stage, where she started out as a chorus girl in the late 1950s. But the actor, who died on August 30th at 80, will be remembered most for her irresistible performance as Rhoda Morgenstern, the mouthy, vivacious neighbor of television's original single career girl, Mary Richards. first on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, then as the lead in hit spinoff Rhoda, Harper spent the 70s embodying a relatable foil to Moore's aspirational hero. Like so many young women of her generation, Rhoda, a frank, neurotic Bronx Jew with a self-deprecating sense of humor, both benefited from and struggled with unprecedented independence. Despite her outward bravado, she wrestled with body image issues. She got married, then survived divorce in an era when such splits remained stigmatized, even as they were growing more common. And if Mary Richards begat Carrie Bradshaw and Ally McBeal, then it was Rhoda Morgenstern who paved the way for the lovably flawed female characters who've ruled sitcoms for the past decade. Liz Lemon, Mindy Lahiri, Issa Dee. Harper won 4 Emmys for the role, but the awards won't define her legacy. Rather, she will be remembered for the estimable extent to which she broadened and humanized the representation of women. To see her impact, just turn on your TV. Judy Berman writing about Valerie Harper. This item is accompanied by a full-color headshot. The caption says, Harper's Rhoda headscarf, seen here in a mid-1970s publicity still from the show, became her signature look. And Valerie Harper is indeed wearing her rust-colored Rhoda headscarf. Underruled. That North Carolina's state legislative maps are an unconstitutional gerrymander, ruled by a 3-judge panel in Raleigh on September 3rd. Settled. Google, with the Federal Trade Commission, for $170 million, a record fine, over allegations that YouTube invaded children's privacy. Underdyed. Peter Lindbergh, fashion visionary. Observance by Katie Lang. And this Katie Lang spells her first name C-A-D-Y, Katie Lang, who writes, the era of the supermodel began with one image. Models Linda Evangelista, Christy Turlington, Naomi Campbell, Cindy Crawford, and Tatiana Patitz on the cover of the January 1990 issue of British Vogue. The man who brought them together was German photographer Peter Lindbergh, whose monochromatic interpretation of high-low glamour launched the women to international superstardom. In doing so, he changed the visual culture of contemporary fashion. Lindbergh, who died September 3rd at 74, was one of the industry's most trusted photographers. His affinity for shooting in black and white was as well known as his distaste for ageism and artifice. He championed women as they were in stripped-down yet elegant portraits, intimate images that defied the shallowness often associated with fashion. The world may look for, quote, perfection and youth, unquote, he told Time in 2016, but beauty, quote, is about emotions, unquote. Lindbergh photographed the world's most famous faces, but in his pursuit of real beauty, what he was really looking for was soul. Observation by Katie Lang, Peter Lindbergh. That item is accompanied by a full-color, half-length photograph of Peter Lindbergh, and he's standing in front of his photograph in black and white of Naomi Campbell. Underreached. an agreement in principle between the U.S. and the Taliban, U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad said on September 2nd. If the deal succeeds, it could herald the end of America's longest-running war. Under announced that former leaders of the Colombian guerrilla group FARC, FARC, will be returning to war, they said in a video posted August 29th. The group's current political leader said he is still committed to peace. Under arrested, opposition activists who have led recent street protests in Moscow by police on September 2nd, arrested by police, ahead of local and regional elections September 8th. Under targeted, immigrants from other African countries targeted in violent riots in Johannesburg on September 1st and 2nd. At least 5 people were killed and 189 arrested in Johannesburg. Under requested, that customers no longer openly carry firearms in stores, requested by Walmart and Kroger on September 3rd, following a series of mass shootings in the U.S. The entire contents of the milestones page. On the facing page is another edition of the sidebar feature, News Ticker. Once again, 3 news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Trump halts deportation of sick migrants. The Trump administration backtracked September 2nd on its decision to start forcing out migrants who had previously been allowed to stay while receiving life-saving medical treatment in the U.S. The protections for sick migrants and their family members had been quietly ended in August. Middle item. UN report spreads blame on Yemen. A September 3rd UN report found that the U.S., the U.K., France, and Iran may be complicit in potential war crimes in Yemen by arming the Saudi-led coalition in its fight against Houthi rebels there. The report came 2 days after a coalition airstrike on a Houthi prison killed more than 100 people. Bottom item, Harvard Frosch allowed U.S. entry. Ismail Adijawi, a Palestinian refugee and Harvard freshman, was denied entry to the U.S. in August after he says Customs and Border Protection officials questioned his friend's social media activity. Adijawi had been sent back to Lebanon, but was allowed into the U.S. on September 2nd, just in time to start classes. This feature is Good Questions. The headline is, Can refusing to name mass shooters help prevent violence? Article by Alejandro de la Garza. After an August 31st mass shooting in West Texas, as questions swirled about the event that had left 7 people dead and 22 injured, Odessa Police Chief Michael Gerke declared that one question would remain unanswered, the shooter's identity. Quote, I'm not going to give him any notoriety for what he did, unquote, Gerke said at a press conference on September 1st. Later that day, however, other law enforcement officials identified the gunman who had been killed by police. Police officers and media outlets are increasingly choosing to downplay the identities of perpetrators to avoid potentially inspiring others to carry out similar atrocities. Following an armed rampage in a Virginia Beach Municipal Center in late May that left 12 dead, Virginia Beach Police Chief James Cervieres said authorities would mention the gunman's name only once, quote, and then he will be forever referred to as the suspect, unquote, to keep the focus on the victims. And after a terrorist attack on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, in March, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern refused to mention the perpetrator's name at all. Quote, publishing the names and photos of these perpetrators often essentially rewards them with fame and attention, unquote, says Adam Lankford, a criminology professor at the University of Alabama, who has written extensively on mass shooters. Quote, they accurately recognize that the more victims you kill, the more attention you get, unquote. The numbers may support that idea. Quote, widespread national media attention paid to these events may be playing some role in actually precipitating some of the events, unquote, explains Sherry Towers, a researcher at Arizona State University, who published a 2015 paper on the contagion effect in mass shootings. Yet simply erasing shooters' names is unlikely to solve the problem, and experts note that the decision must be balanced against other factors, like the public's right to know. Quote, what like-minded individuals applaud is the act, not the actor, unquote, says James Allen Fox, who teaches criminology at Northeastern University and has authored numerous books on mass killings. He says that the contagion effect has little to do with naming perpetrators and showing their photos, and that a bigger problem is a tendency for media to describe shooters in a way that makes them seem larger than life. Others believe focusing on how to talk about mass shootings detracts from the primary factor that studies suggest is most likely to drive such violence: easy access to guns. Towers' 2015 study of mass shootings looked at correlations between gun violence and two things often blamed for it. Quote, we found there was no relationship to mental illness, but we found that there was a very significant relationship to the prevalence of firearm ownership, unquote, Towers says. Quote, we hypothesize that media is playing a role, but it certainly is not the only dynamic that's going on, unquote. Entire article by Alejandro de la Garza. Sharing this page, running along the bottom, is a little feature called Banned Books. And banned is spelled B-A-N-N-E-D, Banned Books. And the headline is Surprising Censorship. This is compiled by Suyin Haynes, who starts off with a Tennessee Catholic school. It was reported August 31st, banned Harry Potter books for containing, quote, actual curses and spells, unquote. Here, other unpredictable prohibitions. And Suyin Hayes lists three running left to right. Number one on the far left, under the caption, Witch Hunt. The classic, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, was written by L. Frank Baum in 1900 in Chicago. But 28 years later, the city's public library banned the book, partly for showing women, including witches, as leaders. Middle item, too adventurous. Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and its wealth of talking creatures was banned in China in 1931 under an official mandate that it was wrong for animals to speak human languages. In the far right, the third item, topless troubles. Where's Waldo was one of the most frequently challenged books in the U.S. from 1990 to 1999, all because it included a cartoon depicting the side of a woman's breast measuring 1/16th of an inch on the page. Moving ahead. And we are now in the opener section. And the subsection leading here is the risk report, where the headline is China's cautious waiting game in Hong Kong. Item by Ian Bremmer. Hong Kong's protests continue. The unrest began in response to a proposed law that would allow Hong Kong to extradite its citizens to face prosecution in mainland China's court system, a plan that stoked fears China could use the law to seize political dissidents and journalists deemed insufficiently compliant to Beijing. But when Hong Kong's police launched a heavy-handed response to the demonstrations, the list of protester demands expanded to include police accountability and new protections for the territory's democracy. On September 4th, Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's beleaguered chief administrator, finally withdrew the bill. For many, it will be, quote, too little and too late now, unquote, in the words of Joshua Wong, a key figure in the protest movement. And Carrie Lam, informationally, spells her last name L-A-M. Next paragraph. Millions have now taken to the streets over the past 14 weeks, and a few demonstrators have resorted to violence. Some protesters are setting fires. Others have thrown bricks and even firebombs. Police have responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and warning shots of live ammunition. Thousands of university and high school students boycotted classes to join the protests. Some organizations, some organizers, have called on Taiwan to grant asylum for activists. Beijing has so far taken a cautious approach. State media has issued increasingly dire threats, and Chinese soldiers have made a show of strength. But President Xi Jinping has avoided a military crackdown. That leaves Lam to try to calm things down. For more than 3 months, she has failed utterly. And leaked audio emerged recently in which she told business leaders during a closed-door meeting that she would resign if she could, if Beijing's direct role in all this weren't already clear. She's also heard on tape explaining that she, quote, unfortunately, has to serve two masters by constitution. That is the central people's government and the people of Hong Kong, unquote. Withdrawing the extradition bill is a victory, but not enough of one to end the protests. But things will get more difficult for the protesters from here. The protest movement does not have unified leadership. Those who want demonstrations to remain peaceful have little sway with rioters. As with the Gilets Jaunes movement in France, poorly coordinated demands extend from the controversial to the impossible, making it hard for the movement to maintain public support indefinitely. President Xi can take his time, confident in the knowledge that people will have to return to work to make a living, and students will eventually go back to class. The economic damage to Hong Kong is already considerable. There was also little useful international support for the demonstrators. European leaders could do no more than issue statements on the subject. And Donald Trump has tried to keep open hopes for trade negotiations with China by protecting his relationship with Xi. Trump has publicly expressed sympathy for Xi and his Hong Kong predicament, and he's made clear he has no intention of siding with protesters. That's part of why Xi believes he can outlast the protesters, as China did following the Umbrella Movement 5 years ago. Some will be tempted to fault Trump for refusing to side with those who demand democracy, but it is Xi who has fueled these protests by his refusal to allow Lam to resign and his uncompromising approach. Many in Hong Kong believe that Beijing means to fundamentally undermine their government. It's clear that Xi won't try to persuade them otherwise. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. Sharing this page in the right sidebar is under the general heading Quick Talk. The headline is No Battle of the Sexes in Space. Compiled by Marcia Ivins, a retired astronaut. It says Marcia Ivins flew 5 space shuttle missions. And she writes here, on August 20th, Vice President Mike Pence chaired a meeting of the recently revived National Space Council. There were 4 guest panelists. 3 spoke about nuclear thermal propulsion, resource use on the moon, and planetary exploration. All interesting and appropriate topics. Then the 4th panelist spoke about gender bias and how NASA needs to, no kidding, realize there are gender differences because sending gender-diverse crews to Mars will be difficult. It was frankly hard to listen to because enough already. We've seen flying gender-diverse crews since 1983. Women do every job a man does in space. I could tell you tales of male engineers' original ideas of clothing and hygiene products for women astronauts, but that was the 70s. By the time I flew in space in the 90s, things changed. A crew member was just a crew member. I fully support the goal of landing American astronauts on the moon and on Mars. I will be proud to wave that flag, because that's the only flag we should be waving. It's the entire item written by Marcia Ivins, retired astronaut. Marcia Ivins flew 5 space shuttle missions. This item is accompanied by a full-color, full-length photograph of Marcia Ivins in space. Caption says, Ivins evaluates a shuttle fire extinguisher in zero-G training. She's wearing a blue jumpsuit with no headgear in the space shuttle. In the view, moving on, the major section, subsection rather, is food, where the headline is, as it gets harder to gather the family for dinner, parents turn to breakfast. Article by Belinda Luscombe. Breakfast, it is oft alleged, is the most important meal of the day. Also, a thing of champions. Plus, a meal you really can have at Tiffany's, parenthetically, as long as you book a month ahead and don't mind paying $35 for avocado toast. And for many families, breakfast is now becoming something else, their primary family meal. As parents deal with unpredictable work days and kids' after-school activities stretch into the evening, gathering the clan around the table at dinner has become a more complicated operation to pull off. Yet the studies that suggest family mealtimes are great for everybody's health and sanity are not ambiguous. Rather than struggle to hold it all together, some parents are just opting to front-load their family time. Quote, "It kind of evolved organically," unquote, says Megan McKimmon of Wilmette, Illinois, who has daughters in 3rd, 5th, and 8th grade. Their middle daughter is a picky eater, and much of their precious dinner time was spent coaxing her to finish her meal. Quote, "We realized that in order to make sure she got enough calories, we had to give her a good breakfast," unquote, says McKinnon. Quote, "It was one of the meals she didn't fight over," unquote. So they began to make the first meal of the day a little more substantial. Then their daughters started to have multiple extracurricular pursuits, which made evenings a bit of a hustle for both parents. Quote, "It clicked with me a couple of years ago when a friend of mine whose kids play a lot of hockey said, 'We've become a breakfast family.' And I realized, oh, we are too," unquote. The McKinnon's meal shift was the result of changes in the way their lives were ordered that are echoed throughout the U.S., if not much of the world. Her husband decided to work from home rather than spend time commuting to an office he didn't need. That means he could have come to breakfast, even if he didn't always eat. With the rise of the gig economy and results-oriented work environments, more and more employees can set their own hours or work locations. But that doesn't mean they put in fewer hours. They just contend with end-of-day spillover. Eating together before work rather than after can be easier to plan for. Like a majority of college-educated mothers, McKinnon went back into the labor force and now works as a preschool administrator and teacher, meaning neither she nor her spouse has made bandwidth to prepare meals. For many parents, that time crunch leads to an increased reliance on eating out or grabbing takeout. But the McKinnons take a different approach. Quote, "I'm not a good cook, and I really don't like cooking," unquote, she says. Quote, "But I can make breakfast," unquote. And, of course, the looming specter of college means many kids' days are full of enriching activities, from sports to sessions with a math tutor. Quote, "I would say dinner with a math tutor. I would say dinner when we have all five of us is once or twice a week. Whether breakfast, whereas," I will repeat this sentence for clarity, quote, "I would say dinner when we have all five of us is once or twice a week, whereas breakfast we can manage four or five times a week," unquote, says Kennan. Quote, "It's the meal we most consistently eat together," unquote. Studies have long shown that eating as a family brings with it a cornucopia of benefits, ranging from decreasing a child's risk for obesity, eating disorders, drug and alcohol use, depression, and teen pregnancy, to improving their academic performance, eating habits, self-esteem, and resilience. Mostly, however, this research has been based on families who have dinner together, which researchers find is still the preferred option. But Ann Fischel, a family therapist and director and co-founder of the Family Dinner Project, a nonprofit organization that endeavors to encourage families to eat together, is a breakfast believer. Quote, "It's our go-to recommendation," unquote, she says. Quote, "When families say they're too busy for dinner, we say, well, what about family breakfast?" unquote. In fact, the organization recently launched an offshoot, the Family Breakfast Project. It's a 7-day guide with recipes, conversation starters, and morning efficiency tips. Fischel is not the only one who's into this idea. Quote, having breakfast family meals has become more common, unquote, says Jerrica Burge, director of the Healthy Eating and Activity Across the Lifespan Center at the University of Minnesota. She has done several studies specifically on breakfast and has found that the health benefits of family meals are not dependent on the time of day. As might be expected, there are some experts who caution that trying to substitute breakfast for dinner is simply a sign that people are overloading their schedules at the cost of time with family and denying their children the chance to process the events of the day with their parents. Quote, the big challenge with family breakfast is that there is a defined time the family has to leave in the morning to get to work and school, unquote, says Blake Jones, an assistant psychology professor at Brigham Young University, who has also studied family meals. Dinner, he points out, can be more leisurely and lead to longer conversations. Quote, with bedtimes getting later, the influence of electronic devices in the evenings and shortened sleep patterns for adults and children, it is often the case that kids and parents don't wake up early enough to get ready for the day and still have enough time to sit down to eat a meal as a family, unquote. Observational studies suggest that the average family dinner lasts about 20 minutes, though if you have little kids, it probably feels much longer. Breakfasts, which, with everybody needing to be out the door at a given time, would logically need to be much quicker, Jones observes. But breakfast advocates point to that shared deadline as a positive thing. Because parents know where everybody is, the options are usually limited to bedrooms, bathroom, or waiting for the bathroom. Before dinner, the family could be flung to the four winds and impossible to locate. One of the biggest advantages for many that family breakfast has over dinner is that it's much more difficult to complain about. Quote, the culinary choices for breakfast tend to inspire less grumbling, says Laura Vanderkam, a time management expert and the author of What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast. That author again, Laura Vanderkam, spelled V-A-N-D-E-R-K-A-M. The book again, What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast. There is much more to this article, but we move on to include more material. And the sidebar accompanying this article is by Jamie Ducharme, and her headline is, How to Get the Kids to Come to the Table. She says, you set the alarm, scramble the eggs, and set the table. There's just one problem. Your children refuse to sit down for breakfast. Here's how to deal with kids who insist they're too tired, not hungry, or not interested in what you made, according to Nancy Oliveira, senior nutritionist at the Massachusetts Brigham and Women's Faulkner Hospital and mother to a 12-year-old. It's divided into three items. First item, start at night. Oliveira says many people aren't hungry in the morning because they eat too late at night. Encourage your kids to stop eating 3 hours before bed, and they'll be more likely to wake up wanting breakfast. A slightly earlier bedtime may also help. Second item in the middle, serve easy foods. You don't need a full buffet. Quote, lighter, bite-sized foods, unquote, like cereal, nuts, and sliced fruit, may get kids to at least pick at something, Oliveira says. Serving your children's favorite flavors or brands may make breakfast feel more like an occasion. Bottom item, set reasonable expectations. If a daily family breakfast just isn't happening, try for twice a week. Making those days count is better than forcing grumpy kids to sulk through a meal they don't want. Quote, the goal is to create this relaxing, welcoming, fun table, unquote, Oliveira says. Quote, it's not even about sitting and eating for 15 minutes. It's that they want to come to the family table. Unquote. That was the entire sidebar article by Jamie Ducharme. And we have just about run out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And you have been listening to North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is your reader, Randall Rickman. Thank you once again for joining us. And the podcast is available of this broadcast at our website, which is ncreadingservice.org. Once again, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And I'll repeat that number, 919-832-5138. This is your reader once again thanking you for joining us and for overlooking your reader's shortfalls, especially during this session. This is North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Randall Rickman. So long until next time when I read your time.